Chapter 27. Gangsters. On the evening of July the 22nd, 1934, people began to emerge from the Biograph Cinema on Chicago's west side. The plainclothes police who were standing around the entrance were tense with anxiety. They were hoping to arrest John Dillinger, America's public enemy number one. They knew he'd gone into the cinema with a brothel madam, who'd tipped them off, and with another woman. What scared them was that some of the women and children in the crowd might get shot if Dillinger went for his gun. They had reason to worry. Last time the federal agents cornered Dillinger in a Wisconsin farmhouse, they got so nervous they opened fire on a car full of innocent people, and several were killed. Dillinger escaped. Now, as Melvin Purvis and his agents waited outside the movie theatre, a police car suddenly drew up. The cinema cashier had noticed the plainclothes cops, assumed they were planning to stage a robbery, and rung the local police station. A federal agent rushed up to the car, showed his identification, and ordered the police to move on fast. A few minutes later, John Dillinger walked out of the cinema with the two women, one of them wearing a bright red dress so the police could identify her. To Purvis's relief, Dillinger pushed clear of the crowd and started along an empty stretch of pavement. Purvis yelled, "Stick 'em up, John, you're surrounded!" Dillinger went for his gun. Dozens of shots sounded, and he crumpled to the pavement. Most criminologists agree that the death of Dillinger was the end of an era. Capone had been in jail since 1932. Prohibition had been repealed in 1933. There were still a few notorious gangsters at large, for example, Creepy Carpus and Mar Baker's gang. But never again would the hunt for a gangster produce the nationwide excitement provoked by Dillinger. It was the notorious Volstead Act, better known as Prohibition, that plunged the United States into its greatest period of lawlessness, starting on January the 16th, 1920. The Puritans and bigots who persuaded the United States Senate to ban all alcoholic drinks thought they were inaugurating an era of clear thinking and clean living. In fact, they were allowing organized crime a stranglehold on the U.S. The Irish and Italian gangs of New York City and Chicago seized their chance to move into the big time. It was the era of Dion O'Banion, Johnny Torrio, Al Capone, Joe Masseria, Salvatore Marzano, and Vito Genovese. On February the 14th, 1929, six Capone gangsters disguised as policemen walked into a garage. Two of them lined seven men up against the wall and mowed them down with submachine gun fire. The St. Valentine's Day massacre shocked the world. Suddenly, the US wanted to be rid of its gangsters. A tough but intelligent Sicilian named Charles Luciano, known as Lucky, organized the killing of many of the old-style gangsters. He then called a meeting of the survivors and warned them that the police were sick of gang warfare. In future, he said, there would be a policy of cooperation. Their common enemy was the law. Their common prey was the public. A few of the older mobsters, such as Dutch Schultz, preferred to carry on in the old way. After Schultz had eliminated his chief rival, Legs Diamond, he himself was shot down as he sat in a restaurant in Newark, New Jersey, in October of 1935. After that, America was more securely than ever in the grip of the mobsters. But the average American knew nothing about it. Quietly and efficiently, Luciano organized Murder Incorporated, a pool of professional killers who committed murder only when the gang bosses decided someone was stepping out of line. Instead of booze, this new syndicate, sometimes known as the Mafia, sometimes as the Cosa Nostra, our thing, dealt in narcotics, gambling, prostitution, extortion, labour racketeering, and anything else that made money. The general public became intrigued by its existence in November 1957, when the New York State Police stumbled on a business conference of more than 60 top racketeers near the village of Appalachian. All at once, Murder Incorporated was world news. There was a national scandal, and a special commission to investigate crime, headed by Senator Kefauver, produced amazing revelations of mass corruption. A top member of the Mafia, Joe Valachi, decided to talk in exchange for police protection. Some of the more notorious gangsters, including Luciano, were deported. A book about the Mafia, written in 1959, ends with a chapter entitled Twilight of the Villains? The years since then have shown that the answer is definitely not. Soon after the immense success of Mario Puzo's Cosa Nostra novel The Godfather in 1971, there were further outbreaks of gang warfare in New York City. Gang leader Joe Colombo was shot and critically wounded at a rally in Central Park. The rival gangster responsible for this shooting, Joe Gallo, was himself murdered as he celebrated his birthday in April of 1972. In between these shootings, there were a dozen other mafia executions. Now, many years after the death of John Dillinger, America is still firmly in the hands of its mobs. Capone and Luciano have been replaced by another mafia leader, but there is always a godfather ready to step into the shoes of his predecessor. Will this ever change? An unprejudiced look at history suggests the answer is probably not. If prostitution is the world's oldest profession, then gangsterism is probably the second oldest. Moreover, scientific investigation suggests that this is more than just plain wickedness. It is a deep-rooted animal instinct, an instinct that is activated and intensified by conditions of overcrowding, not only in present-day communities and cities, but in the living areas of long ago. This gives an interesting insight into the beginnings of crime and of gangs. It's known that most of man's earliest cities, some of which sprang up 5,000 years BC, contained overcrowded slums. Now, this may sound strange. After all, the world of those days had a tiny population. So why didn't the people spread themselves out more? The answer is simple. Men built cities for mutual protection. They preferred to be huddled together. Moreover, these cities were often in river valleys, where there was a limited amount of space to expand. The result was inevitable: crime on a large scale. To people from quiet country villages, the wickedness of the cities must have seemed terrifying, as is instanced in the Bible with its stories of Sodom and Gomorrah and those godless cities of Mesopotamia that were destroyed by the flood, which actually took place in around 4000 BC. The city, therefore, literally created crime, at least large-scale crime. And unfortunately, the pestilence soon overflowed into the surrounding countryside. Travellers were robbed and murdered. Small villages were overrun by robber bands who killed the men, raped the women, and burned the houses. It can thus be said with some confidence that the first gangsters appeared soon after the first cities. But at this point, an important distinction must be made. There are two distinct kinds of gangster, which, for convenience, can be labelled the bandit and the true gangster. Bandit obviously means the same as gangster, since a gang is a band, but their motivations are different. To put it simply, the gangster tends to be crueler and more vicious than the bandit. The bandit lives in rural areas. He has space. He may have taken to crime for a variety of reasons, but one of these is not overcrowding. He prefers to be a member of a band because a loner in wide open spaces is a demoralising business. Criminal loners often commit far more atrocious crimes than bandits because boredom and solitude make them lose their sense of identity. Apart from his criminal activities, the bandit may be a normal human being with normal human emotions. On the other hand, the man who becomes a gangster because of the pressure of an overcrowded slum has often suffered permanent emotional damage. To begin with, as already noted, overcrowding produces bad mothers and brutal fathers. The true gangster is the product of the slum, and he sees the world as a place to be plundered, if he can get away with it. The city of Hong Kong offers some gruesome examples of this dating from recent years. Trapped between the sea and steep hills, Hong Kong is one of the most overcrowded cities in the world, and its murder rate has always been high. After World War II, the population quickly rocketed from 500,000 to more than 2.5 million. Consequently, there was a terrifying wave of gang murders, murders so atrocious that the police speak of them as the work of horror cults. In 1958, there were more than 900 murders. That's 3 times the American murder rate and 36 times the English. These horror cults are, in fact, Chinese tongs or triad societies. The earliest tongs were called the Three Harmonies Societies. Like their American counterpart, the Mafia, they operate prostitution, drug rackets, protection and extortion. But their methods of ensuring obedience depend upon terrorism. For example, in 1958, a rich merchant named Ko Sun Wei, together with 4 of his family, were horribly murdered in his house in Kowloon. The victims were staked out, their arms and legs spread-eagled. 3 women, the merchant's 2 daughters and his daughter-in-law, were raped repeatedly, then tortured to death with knives. 1 woman was still alive when the police arrived, but was unable to speak. Her tongue had been cut out. These were only 5 among 350 murders that took place in Hong Kong in September 1958. Sergeant Arthur Ogilvie of the Hong Kong Police, who gives these figures, also mentions that during the riots of 1956, triad societies took the opportunity to pillage more than $25 million worth of goods. With a figure of this size involved, it can be seen that crime in modern Hong Kong is an even bigger business than it was in the Chicago of the 1920s. The interesting point here is the verification of observations about overcrowding. It produces true gangsters, men who are adept in cruelty and violence because they're unable to experience ordinary human emotions. Bearing in mind this important distinction, it can be seen that many of the famous criminals and gang leaders of the past 200 years have been bandits rather than gangsters. For example, Australia's most famous criminal, Ned Kelly, was definitely a bandit. Kelly, the son of an Irish farmer and former convict, became Australia's public enemy number one when he killed three constables at Stringybark Creek in 1877. From then on, he lived the traditional life of the bandit on the run, moving around the countryside with his gang, which included his brother Dan, and robbing banks. He made himself head and body armour, weighing 97 pounds, and was wearing it when the police finally ambushed his gang in Glen Rowan. He was only 24 when he was executed in 1880. Asked why he had decided to confront the police at Glen Rowan, Kelly made a reply that was to be echoed by many American gangsters of the Bonnie and Clyde era. "A man gets tired of being hunted like a dog. I wanted to see the thing end." The most significant feature about Kelly is that he was a man who thought he had a grievance against the law, and in this he resembles many of the famous bandits, from Billy the Kid to John Dillinger. Whether the grievance is real or not is beside the point, but it starts the bandit off on the road that leads to the gallows, or the final bloody shootout with the police. The story of South Africa's most famous gangster may be taken as typifying the pattern. William Foster was born in 1886, and his family moved to Johannesburg in 1900. While still under 20, William decided to seek his fortune in German Southwest Africa. Plodding around in the desert one day, he met two companions who were driving a pack of donkeys. He joined them, and a few miles further on, all three were arrested and charged with stealing the donkeys. The young men claimed they had found the donkeys wandering in the desert, and they were driving them back to the nearest village. William lost his temper with the officious German magistrate. As a result of this, he was sentenced to a month in prison, while his companions were allowed to go free. The injustice of this infuriated him. When he came out of jail, he was aggressive and inclined to drink too much. A series of minor offences led to further prison sentences, and a thoroughly resentful William Foster was ready to become a complete criminal. He fell in love and wanted money to marry. His first major crime, therefore, was a well-planned robbery of a jeweller. He and two accomplices ran into bad luck and an efficient police force, and each received 12 years hard labour. Foster's girlfriend, Peggy, married him while he was in jail awaiting trial. 9 months later, Foster escaped. In a bank robbery a few months later, two clerks were killed, and Foster's career as a hunted dog began. Like Kelly, he had an amazing ability to shoot his way out of tight corners, and as the deaths piled up, he became South Africa's most wanted man. Whenever possible, his wife, who now had a baby daughter, joined him. The tragic end came in September 1914, when Foster and two companions were cornered in a cave in the Kensington Ridge. One of the men committed suicide. Foster's parents, his sisters, and his wife Peggy were sent for. They agreed to try and persuade him to give himself up, and bravely entered the cave. The parents and sisters came out with Foster's baby daughter. Then three shots rang out. Peggy had decided to die with her husband. In the United States, the gangster era began long before Prohibition. New York was America's first major city, and as early as 1790, it had slums that were as foul and as miserable as any in the world. In the 100 or so rooms of the old brewery, human beings were packed in like rats, and murders averaged one a night. When the district was demolished in 1852, the builders filled numerous sacks with human bones and remains. There were many tough and colourfully named gangs. The Dead Rabbits, the Roach Guards, the Shirt Tails, the Plug Uglies, which referred to their huge plug or top hats. Then, during the 1840s, Tammany Hall politicians discovered that gangsters could be useful allies, threatening rivals and drumming up votes. And it was from this period that the real history of American gangsterism began. At the time, most of the gangsters were Irish and, oddly enough, Chinese. The Chinese were accustomed to their triad societies at home. When they came to settle in America, mostly on the West Coast, they naturally formed themselves into tongs for mutual protection. The Chinese were also among the first to practice gang assassination. In 1897, a rich Chinese gangster, Little Pete, owner of several gambling houses, was sitting in a barber's chair in San Francisco. He'd made the mistake of sending his bodyguard out to find the result of a horse race. Two men, who had been trailing him for months, awaiting their opportunity, came in and literally filled him with lead. The killers were never caught. A similar scene was to be repeated half a century later, when in October 1957, Albert Anastasia, one of Murder Incorporated's assassins, was shot in a Manhattan hotel barbershop. In the early years of the century, most of America's most formidable gangsters were Chinese. By comparison, the Irish were relatively amateurish and badly organised. But another racial group was slowly achieving ascendancy, the Italians. Fleeing from the poverty of their homeland and from its chronic political troubles, they also had their tradition of secret societies. The word mafia originally described a Sicilian outlaw who had taken to the hills covered with low scrub, or mafia, to hide from justice, either at the hands of the police or of the family of someone he had killed. The mafia came to New Orleans under the name of the Black Hand in the 1880s. Almost without exception, mafiosi preyed upon their fellow citizens, who in turn were too terrified to appeal to the police of their adopted country. Similarly, the Irish gangsters tended to prey upon their fellow Irish, and the Chinese upon the Chinese. As the century progressed, the Chinese slowly lost their reputation as gangsters, perhaps because many of them succeeded through hard work and intelligence in escaping from the slums, and the Irish and their bitter rivals, the Italians, took over. Then came the double-edged sword of prohibition. Chicago's crime industry was run by men like the O'Donnell brothers and the flamboyant Dion O'Banion, who was quoted as saying angrily, "To hell with them Sicilians!" On November the 10th, 1924, three men walked into O'Banion's flower store and unceremoniously gunned him down. The man who arranged the murder commented ironically, "O'Banion's head got away from under his hat." His name was Al Capone. The United States had entered its third and most violent era of gangsterdom. It's still in the midst of it.